Good morning, everyone. I didn't expect anyone to respond. be helpful if you've got your Bibles open to that passage in 1 Samuel. We'll be looking at those chapters, or chapter 1 and half of chapter 2. Well, it's fairly obvious, I think, that as we look out at the world, that we realize that our world has problems. And when we're confronted with those problems, our world is going to look for solutions to those problems in a bunch of different ways. So for some, the solution is found in education. If we can just bring literacy and numeracy and education to people, then our world is going to be in a better place. Will be more rational and able to make good moral choices for the good of the society. Or for others, the solution is found in technology or in science, in nuclear energy or space colonization or genetic engineering or biotech or AI. Or for others, the solution is a political solution, that if we can just invest our leaders, or at least the good leaders, with enough money or authority or enough power, then they will be the ones who will be able to bring the change that our world so desperately needs. And that's just some of the choices on offer when it comes to the solution to the problems of our world. Our world has problems, and our world has always had problems. This is nothing new. And as we begin this series in 1 Samuel, we are confronted not with just a world that has problems, but with a nation that has problems. And those problems aren't immediately obvious as you begin the book, but the cracks are there in the nation of Israel, and they become more and more exposed as the book continues. And so we're going to go through the passage in a moment that we read, but I want to just point out those cracks. I want to just point out those problems that are festering just below the surface in the nation of Israel, because they're going to help us get a sense of what God is about to do for his people and what God is going to do through Hannah. So I've got 5 indicators that there are some massive problems in Israel. The first indicator actually comes from the book that comes right before this book, which isn't the book of Ruth. In our English Bibles are arranged chronologically, and so Ruth comes right before Samuel, but in the Hebrew ordering of the scriptures, they're arranged more theologically. And so the book that comes right before the book of Samuel is actually the book of Judges. And how does the book of Judges end? It says, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. Actually, Israel does have a king. It's God. But they've rejected his rule, and so they think they have no king, and so they do whatever they want. And that is the first indicator that there is a massive problem in Israel. The second indicator that things aren't good is there in verse 9. Have a look at it with me. Chapter 1, verse 9. Once, when they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on his chair by the doorpost of the Lord's house. It says there that Eli is sitting on his chair, but the word is almost always used to refer to a royal throne. And so perhaps Eli has gotten a little bit too big for his boots. The priest is meant to be serving the people, but perhaps Eli is more accustomed to being served by them. Then the third indicator is Hannah and Hannah's prayer in the house of the Lord. Now, Hannah is praying in the house of the Lord, and look at what happens there in verse 12. As she kept on praying to the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying in her heart, and her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. Eli thought she was drunk and said to her, "How long are you going to stay drunk? Put away your wine." Now just think about that scene for a moment. Here's Hannah praying in the house of the Lord, and Eli's immediate assumption is that she's drunk. Right? How bad do things have to be so that the priest, The priest of the Lord assumes that when he sees someone talking in the house of the Lord, that he assumes drunkenness rather than prayer. Now, things have gotten so bad that Eli doesn't even recognize when someone is praying. And then later in chapter 3, he's not even going to be able to recognize when God is speaking. That's number 3. And then number 4, it's there in verse 16. Hannah says in verse 16, "I'm not a wicked woman." And the irony there is that the words that she uses is the same words that the author of this book will use to describe Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, later on in chapter 2, verse 12. Hophni and Phinehas are the sons of Eli, also priests for the Lord, but they are wicked and sinful and evil. They're serving themselves rather than the people. See, there's these little hints scattered throughout that things are bad. The Israelites are not following their God. They've rejected him, and they're following their own evil desires from the leaders of Israel right down to the individuals. Israel have fallen far. And that brings us to the fifth indicator. It's Elkanah and his family. This small little family is a microcosm, an example of the fallout of what happens when Israel rejects its king. In this family, the devastation of sin, the consequences of Israel's spiritual depravity are played out. Sin has ruined everything. And so within this family, there's taunting and mistreatment, there's jealousy and barrenness and grief. And this family is a little picture that indicates that things are not meant to be like this. That this is what happens when people reject God. And so as the book opens, we meet Elkanah, who's an Ephraimite with two wives. Peniah has children and Hannah has none. But we need to know that there's actually nothing important about Elkanah. He hasn't played a major role in any of the Bible story up until this point. He doesn't live anywhere important either. He is a nobody from a nothing town. But every year, in faithfulness to God, he goes up to Shiloh to worship and sacrifice to God. And we're told twice more that Hannah is not able to have children. And Hannah's barrenness is an illustration of the spiritual barrenness of the people of Israel. But childlessness is not a hindrance to the plans and purposes of God. And Hannah knows that, and so she prays. As I said at the start, there are lots of things that people think are going to fix this world. But Hannah doesn't turn to education or technology or science. She turns to her God, the only one who can work at a deep enough level to reverse the spiritual depravity of her nation. And what is it that she prays? It's there in chapter 1, verse 11. And she made a vow saying, "Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head." See, Hannah knows that God is in the business of reversing the fortunes of the people. She knows that God can bring life from a dead womb. God has done it before, and so she prays to God to remember her misery and do what he has done before. But Hannah isn't just thinking about herself. She's thinking about the bigger picture. Notice there that she promises to give her son back to the Lord all the days of her life, of his life. She prays that God would use her situation for his own good purposes. And we're going to see in Hannah's second prayer that Hannah really is thinking about the larger picture. This isn't about fulfilling her longing for a child, but about something far, far bigger. But as you read her prayer, it sounds like Hannah is making a bargain with God, trying to make God do what she wants. But later on, we're told that she actually finds comfort before having a child. It's there in verses 17 and 18. Eli answered, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant you what you have asked of him." She said, "May your servant find favor in your eyes." Then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Right? At that point, she doesn't even know that she's going to have a baby, and yet she's found comfort, which shows us that the Lord has given her contentment and comfort without the child that she longed for. Her prayer was actually never a deal or a bargain with God. It's not that she was offering something to God to get what she wanted. Rather, she wanted a child to offer to God. She wanted to play her part in God's plan, and she will. She will have a son called Samuel, who is the kingmaker and the kingbreaker. Samuel, who will anoint the first two kings of Israel and represents the beginning of five massive changes for Israel. This small prayer is the rock that starts an avalanche. In the books of Samuel, there's five massive shifts that are going to begin to happen to the nation of Israel. Firstly, the nation is going to move from separate tribes to a united nation. Israel moves from being kind of separate tribes with their own parcel of land and their own kind of separate governments to being this united nation under one king. And they haven't really had that since before entering into the land. The second change is they have a change in government from a federation to a monarchy. And then thirdly, they go from vulnerability to dominance. The other nations continue to oppress Israel, but King David is going to bring liberation and freedom. He finally does what Israel has struggled to do for so long, to deal with the enemies that have plagued them throughout their life. And fourthly, the religious and political center is going to move from Shiloh to Jerusalem. And fifthly, the process begins where they go from having a tabernacle, a kind of tent, to a temple. That transition doesn't get completed within these books, but it's heading in that direction. It begins in 2 Samuel. David is promised by God that his son will build a temple for him. There's these five massive changes across the books of Samuel, and it is all precipitated by this incredible woman who humbly prays for God to give her a child that she can give to the Lord for his work. Hannah, this nobody from an insignificant family living in a backwater town, will give birth to the kingmaker and kingbreaker. Well, when Samuel is weaned, when he's old enough, Hannah fulfills her vow, and she takes him along to the house of the Lord at Shiloh and hands him over to Eli for service to the Lord. And here we get Hannah's second prayer, this second incredible prayer that moves from her personal life to the national life of Israel, and then finally to the world at large. There's these three steps in the prayer, from personal to national, and then to the world. She begins there with herself, by reminding herself that her joy doesn't come from external factors, but her joy comes from the Lord. It doesn't come from her circumstances or her situation or her feelings. Her joy is in the Lord. Look at that with me. Chapter 2, verse 1. Then Hannah prayed and said, "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord my horn is lifted high. My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance." See, the problem is that when our joy is placed in other things, when our joy is placed in things like our circumstances or our situation or our feelings, it means that our joy can shift and change whenever those situations and circumstances change. But a joy that comes from the Lord or is found in the Lord, that can't be shifted, that can't change. It can't be lost, it can't be changed, because despite what might happen in our life, it is grounded in something deeper and richer and greater. Joy in the Lord is not dependent on the external situation that we're in, but rather it's founded on the immutability of who God is and the salvation that he has accomplished for us in Jesus. It's because of what God has done for us in Christ that we can say along with Hannah, "In the Lord, my horn, my strength is lifted up. He is the one who lifts us up, giving us strength and hope and joy when everything around us is crumbling. And it speaks there of her personal deliverance of God as he has rescued her from her problems. She says, "My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance." Her problems have been a representation of Israel's wider problems. And so now her victory is also a representation of the victory that will come to Israel through King David. Hannah doesn't know exactly what God will do, but she sees with the eyes of faith of what God can do. And Hannah continues to remind us of what God is like there in verses 2 to 3. She says there about God that there is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. Do not keep talking so proudly or let your mouth speak such arrogance. For the Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed. Nothing in this world compares to God. And so he should be our rock. He should be the one that we put our hope and security and trust in. When we're facing the shifting shadows of this life, and when things are always changing and things are never certain, he is the one that we are to cling to. And as we remind ourselves of what God is like, that should filter down into the way that we speak and act. See, if our joy and security and hope comes from God, then things like arrogance and pride are ruled out of play. We can't boast in our own strength. We can't boast in our own abilities or in our own actions. No, our security rests in God. And so we're to live by faith and trust in him, not by our own strength. Not in what we can do, not in what I can do, not in what I can accomplish, but in him. That's the personal. And then in verses 4 to 8, Hannah moves now to the national. And in particular, she notices that God can always reverse our circumstances, and not necessarily in ways that we might like. And so in verses 4, the bows of the warriors can be broken. And in verse 5, those who are full can be hungry. And she, who has many sons, can pine away. See, God can bring down the mighty, but he can also raise up the lowly. And so in verse 4, those who stumble are armed for strength, and those who are hungry can become full, and those without children can have 7 children. See, Hannah's point is that God can do what he wants. He can raise up, or God can bring down. And what Hannah understands is that all of those things that often bring us pride and contentment can easily be stripped away. See, ultimately, the future is in God's hands, and he can reverse the fortunes of whoever he wants, for good or for bad. The Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. And so verse 6, the Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He sits them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. See, this is the kind of universal truth of how God works in the world, where the first will be last and the last will be first. And so her prayer becomes a plea for God to do that again. She is asking God to reverse the spiritual problems of her nation. And that great reversal begins to happen throughout the books of Samuel. But it doesn't begin with the leaders of Israel. Instead, it begins here with Hannah, a nobody from a nothing town who gives birth to someone who crowns kings and deposes them. And in the final verse, 3 verses, she looks beyond Israel to the whole world. Look at the second half of verse 8. For the foundations of the earth are the Lord's. On them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful servants, but the wicked will be silenced in the place of darkness. It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He gives strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. See, our own strength and power won't make things better. Only God can do that. So what is she praying? What is that Hannah saying? She's saying, please God, silence the wicked. Break those who oppose you. Bring judgment on those who have rejected you. That's her prayer. And most of all, give strength to your king and exalt the horn of his anointed. Now, the final line sounds like a prediction of the great King David. And David will see Hannah's prayer fulfilled in his lifetime, but the prayer doesn't quite fit neatly with David, because the judgment of the Lord hasn't reached the ends of the earth in these books. Right? And at the end of 2 Samuel, David will sing a very similar song. His song looks back to Hannah's prayer here, and David sees the fulfillment of it. But her prayer is only partially fulfilled in King David, because it's meant to find its complete fulfillment in King Jesus, when he returns to judge the living and the dead, to bring judgment to the ends of the earth. Hannah's prayer looks not just to her changing fortune or to the changing fortune of her nation, but to the moment when God will give his Messiah, his anointed, the power and strength to rule the world. See, Hannah gets that God's king is not just a king for Israel, but a king for the whole world. See, remember the problem of Israel? The book of Judges. Israel had no king, and everyone did as they saw fit. And that's not just a problem that's localized to Israel. The other nations had kings, but they don't have God's king. And that is really what the story of Samuel is all about. See, the books of Samuel are all about how God is going to establish his rule through his chosen king. How God is going to establish his kingdom by the king that he chooses. Divine rule will now be through a human king. And then one day, or many, many years later, Mary is going to sing an almost identical song about her son Jesus. And just like Hannah, God is going to use Mary, another woman, another nobody from a nothing town, to set his king on his throne. See, where Hannah's son makes or breaks kings, Mary's son is the king of the world. Not now, both a human king and a divine king who will sit on God's throne and rule the world. Jesus is the great king that the book of Samuel is talking about. And one day, Jesus will deal with the problem of our rebellion against God. One day he will return to bring judgment to the ends of the earth, just like Hannah prayed. And so here's my question. Here's the question for us. Do you see the world as Hannah sees it? Do you see with the eyes of faith? I don't know about you, but when I read Hannah's prayer, it feels extraordinary. You know, that she could see beyond her situation and see into what God is doing in Israel and for the world. And compared to that, often our prayers seem so very tiny. But Hannah has an understanding of how God works that is just so vastly different to our own. Where we see only chaos, kind of a world left to its own devices, Hannah sees God who is completely in control. Her view is so great that she can see past what is directly in front of her and look to the bigger picture of what God is doing and will do. Now, this is what the Bible calls living by faith and not by sight. See, our view of what God is doing in the world is often very nearsighted. But Hannah's prayer reminds us that God is always working things out according to his purposes, which is to bring everything together under his chosen king. So how will God fix the world? Not through education or technology, but through his king. See, God is bringing all things together under the rule of King Jesus. And the way that God has done that in the past, and the way he will continue to do that, is by raising up and bringing low. See, God doesn't work out his plans and purposes through the mighty and the strong, but through the meek and the mild. He raises up and he brings low. And so the first will be last and the last will be first. That is exactly what happened to Jesus, who experienced suffering before glory, whose throne was a cross, and whose victory was through death. God works out his plans and purposes to bring things together under King Jesus through the humble, the weak, the lowly, the poor in spirit, those who mourn, those who are persecuted, people like Hannah, and nobody from nowhere. So do you fear being poor or weak? Do you fear death? Are you afraid of missing out? Do you like being noticed? Do you like being in control? Do you long for recognition and status? That is not the way God works. He doesn't choose the wise or the influential or the most important people. He chooses the foolish and the weak and the lowly and the despised for his work. And so here's the thing. If we want to be part of what God is doing in the world, then the path is clear. It's humility and service. It's to be the last and the servant of all, to follow Jesus in the way of the cross. Or as Nikolaus van Zinzendorf said, we should preach the gospel, die, and be forgotten. See, the goal is not for people to build statues of us or write books about us, but to take our place as humble servants in God's kingdom. Preach the gospel, die, be forgotten. See, Hannah isn't remembered because of her mighty acts, but because of her faith and trust in God and her willingness to be used by him and for his glory. I'm going to invite the musos up. I'm going to sing a song that really kind of taps into that, that really speaks about our trust of God and our need for him to be at work in our lives. As they come up, though, why don't you just take a moment to consider the path you're on, your actions, perhaps your attitude towards, you know, service and humility, being in control or positions of power. What does that look like for you? Do you fear, I'll just ask the questions again, do you fear being weak or poor? Do you fear death? Do you fear missing out? Do you like being noticed? Do you like being in control? Do you long for recognition and status? Right? They are not the way God works. We'll sing in a moment.